This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. During President Trump's campaign, he claimed that he was the only one who could fix what was wrong in Washington. But my next guest, a physicist, says that the math of quantum mechanics tells us it's our form of government, our system, that's broken, and no single person can fix it. He says, according to a framework borrowed from quantum field theory, no single person can manage the complexities of our government. Not Trump, not Hillary Clinton, not Bernie Sanders. Our democracy is just too complex now to be governed the way it is. Well, is he right? My guest, Yanir Bar-Yam, does have a track record. He crunched big data to successfully predict that the Arab Spring would happen. So what does he propose we do? Yanir Bar-Yam is director of the New England Complex System Institute in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Welcome to Science Friday.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
You're welcome. So how does quantum mechanics help us understand the complexity of something like the U.S. government?
So it's a mathematical formalism that was originally developed in quantum mechanics. What it's really about is the realization that you don't always have a specific set of quantities that describe a system, but rather you need to think about how the things that you want to describe changes as you zoom in and see more and more detail.
Mm-hmm. And you use this math to study complex systems before, right?
Yes. I mean, it was transferred from quantum mechanics into the study of phase transitions in materials, so boiling water. It turns out that at a particular point called a critical point, the structure of the material doesn't know whether it's water or vapor, and it's kind of fluctuating back and forth at all scales. So there are large fluctuations and smaller fluctuations. And so if you think about it as a smooth system, you just don't describe what's happening. And you have to think about it by zooming in and seeing progressively more fluctuations that are happening.
So when you apply that framework to the U.S. government, you're saying that you're seeing a very complex system that no one person can manage.
Well, it's not the government itself. It's what the government is dealing with, right? You can think of the society that we're part of. You can also think of the world that we're responding to. And all of the things that are happening all over the world, including domestically and internationally, there's a lot of stuff happening. And then how do you respond to everything that's going on? And if you are a policymaker, you want to focus on the largest things that are happening. But what happens if the largest things give way to just slightly less large things, and then there are more things a little bit finer that you have to worry about? And it's really hard to respond to all of them at once. And that's what the challenge is.
Mm-hmm. So you're sort of surrounded by unintended consequences.
Well, so the point of not being able to respond to everything is that everything that you do triggers effects in these other things that are going on in the system, and those are the unintended consequences that people talk about.
Well, but don't we have a system of checks and balances that are supposed to take care, you know, watch out for each other?
The fundamental challenge is actually that as soon as you have a hierarchical organizational structure, what you're doing is you're making the assumption that one person can understand and respond to the most important things that are happening. And in this case, where you have so many very important things that are happening, one person just can't do that.
So how do you know? I mean, and let me go back and ask this question. This wasn't always the case. From studying your work, I see that there's sort of an arc of history here where we started out with simple societies and got them more complex. There was a time when you could govern with a single person?
Yeah. I mean, we know that hierarchical systems have really been very successful over history. You know, we had empires and kingdoms, and we had companies that were, you know, very hierarchical, and you know, that seemed to work very well. I mean, democracy, as much as we elect from the public elects, we still are electing representatives that are just a few people that are making decisions for the country as a whole. And that worked very well, and it kind of started falling apart in the 1980s. And by now, it should be quite apparent that, you know, these systems that are hierarchical are just not able to deal with the complexity of the world that we're in.
So what was that tipping point in the 80s?
So the what happened during the 1980s is that the world, I mean, over the period of the last century and until today, is that the world became much more interdependent. You know, things happening in everywhere in the world, whether it's in small countries like Kuwait and the Gulf, you know, the Gulf War, or in Japan or in North Korea, or, you know, almost anywhere in the world, you have events and they affect everything. Whether it's economic events, the financial crisis propagation, whether it's governance and disruption of social order, or whether it's diseases, you know, everything is being affecting what's happening everywhere else. So those are the, that's the functional drivers of what happened in terms of complexity.
Okay, so if the hierarchy, and I'm going to look at this visually as a vertical system, is not working, can we more horizontalize it? And spread it out and make it work.
Absolutely. And that's kind of the principle. I mean, if we stick to hierarchies, we're going to fail. But there are other structures that can work, and more network distributed organizations. And you can see that there's a cultural shift happening where people are realizing that, you know, how much you rely on leaders is actually causing systems to be less successful, right? In the past, we would say, that, you know, if you had a problem, you put someone in charge. And today, that's just not going to work. And it seems that people realize that, you know, everything from, you know, how we think about corporations, where they're developing very laterally functioning and decision-making in organizations, to, you know, social movements and how people mm-hmm. think about what's happening in that context.
Well, the buck has to stop someplace in a system. So in who would make those tough decisions in a more horizontal
situation? Well, that's kind of, you're kind of making the assumption that is really not valid in this regime. I mean, if you think about your brain, I mean, there are, I don't know, people, you know, the number of neurons in your brain is somewhere between 10 to the 12th and 10 to the 16th, depending upon who you ask. And there isn't one neuron that's telling the other neurons what to do. It's a collective behavior that really is responsible for how you think about, how you decide, and what you do. And the same thing can, in principle, happen in society. We have to form the organizations that make that work. And there's a lot of experimentation today in that context, but in the public sector, it's much harder to change the organizational structures that we have established by constitution, and shifting the decision-making from the existing representative democracy to alternatives that involve many more people in making decisions is a process that we don't have a formula for.
Are you saying we should go from a republic to a pure democracy, so then everybody has a wider participation?
So voting is a very poor way to combine people's understanding. It's not a very successful, if you think about it, everyone having one vote doesn't really take advantage of the differences in what people know and what they can contribute. Your brain is structured so that different neurons are responsible for different kinds of things. And really, the way the brain is structured is not just about individuals, but how they're connected to mm-hmm. each other. So the same kind of thing in society would look like you know, different groups of people that are involved in different kinds of decisions. And the reason why they're involved in those decisions is that they actually do them very well. And it's not even an individual trait as much as it is a collective trait of how the system is organized.
Well, we have lobbyists who do make decisions and do them very well, but we don't think very highly of them. How would this be different?
The problem with that way of thinking is that you really have to have the decisions being evaluated on the basis of their success in doing what we as a society would like them to do. And so if people don't think very highly of those decision makers, what we need to do is find out how to evaluate better the decision makers and put the responsibility in their hands.
And who would be those decision makers?
Well, so that's a really deep question. And basically what we have to do is engage as a society in the challenge of identifying not just individuals, but really groups and people that are able to together make good decisions. And part of the challenge, if I can add, is to understand that just like we talked about in the other context, there are different things happening at different scales of the system. So some decisions are not relevant to everybody. They should be done more locally. And some decisions should be done more globally. And understanding how to separate the different kinds of decisions to different groups of people is important.
And how do we begin this process?
To a great extent, I think that we're beginning to engage in that. I mean, this is something that is being done intentionally in companies that are adopting more distributed organizational structures and really have been adopting them since the 1980s. But the societal engagement in this is happening in the form of people caring about and thinking about and talking about decisions that are being made in policy. What we have to do, however, is to create mechanisms by which that participation translates into actual decision-making mm-hmm. rather than shifting it once again to one person or a few people who have that authority.
Danir Baryam is director of the New England Complex Systems Institute in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Great to talk with you.
We're going to take a break, and coming up, the Great Lakes have come a long way since they were literally catching on fire in the late 60s. But new challenges from climate change and invasive species are making their mark. Will the Great Lakes stay great? We're going to talk about that wonderful group of freshwater bodies right after this break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Pop quiz time. Can you name all five of the Great Lakes? Not hard if you live on one of the Great Lakes. You have that helpful acronym, HOMES. Huron, Ontario, Michigan, Erie, and Superior. As I say, if you live there, you know what it is. And just like you know, the lakes have been going through some tough times over the last 100 years, from the spread of parasite sea lampreys in the 30s to pollution so bad you couldn't swim in Lake Erie in the 70s, to the arrival of the invasive zebra and quagga mussels at the end of the last century. And as the climate continues to warm, we want to know what else awaits the lakes. After all, collectively, they make up 1/5 of all the fresh water on the planet. And some 40 million people rely on them for drinking water, plus the fishing, the recreational boating, and of course, the shipping. And if you've ever stood on the edge of one on a clear summer day, you know there's something a bit magical about how big they are. You can't see the edge. Do you live near the Great Lakes? Have you ever noticed them changing over the years? We'd like to know about it. Give us a call, 844-724-8255. 844-SCI-TALK. Of course, you can tweet us at SciFry. So we're going to talk about the challenges ahead for the Great Lakes. Let me introduce my guests. Dan Egan, a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and senior water policy fellow at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. He's also the author of a really good new book, The Death and Life of the Great Lakes, out from Norton this spring. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Harvey Bootsma, Associate Professor of Freshwater Sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
And Donna Cashin, Associate Professor of Aquatic Ecology at Wayne State University and a visiting scientist at NOAA's Great Lakes Environmental Research Lab. And she is based in Brighton, Michigan. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me.
Dan, let me begin with you, because your book is titled The Death and Life of the Great Lakes. Does that mean there's nothing to worry about in 2017?
I would say absolutely not. But yeah, the title is in a way it's a nod to Jane Jacobs' Death and Life of the Great American Cities. But obviously, the Great Lakes aren't dead. But in a way, you know, they aren't what they were 100 years ago. They're in many ways completely different. So there is a new type of life going on out there, and that was the rationale for the title.
Give me what you would consider the biggest problem. Name just one for me.
Invasive species, and specifically, I would say quagga mussels.
Why?
Because the quagga mussels have just fundamentally rewired the way energy flows through the lakes. They are the dominant organism out there, and they make their living by filtering plankton out of the water, and so they've basically taken out the bottom of the food chain, and obviously everything above that suffering.
Donna Cashin, you know, a lot of people just fly over the Great Lakes a lot, and they see it from an airplane. Tell the rest of us what's so wonderful about having the Great Lakes here.
Well, one is that it's the fifth of the fresh water available to the world. That's kind of the big basic one, but it's the recreational value that comes with it, the commercial value that comes with it, and what it means to the people who live in the region for recreation and all those things. It's very important for all those reasons.
Mm. Dan, you agree?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They define the region, you know, culturally, largely, to a large degree, economically. And yeah, I mean, anybody who lives here knows that these are the things that make the Great Lakes region so great.
Let me ask Harvey Bootsma to tell us, we're talking about the mussels changing the Great Lakes ecosystem. Can we say that it's all bad news? There's got to be some good news in the lakes.
Yeah, I guess it depends what you value. If you like really nice clear water, then mussels aren't necessarily a bad thing. They're great filtering machines, and they filter all the particles out of the water. And as a result, many of the Great Lakes now are much clearer than they have been in the past. So if that's your only management goal, then you might think that they're a good thing. But as Dan pointed out, there are quite a few negative aspects associated with the mussels as well. But I should point out that we have had a number of challenges in the past with regard to the Great Lakes. And while it's easy to focus on the problems and challenges we have, I think it's also important to remember that we have had success stories in the past as well, managing some of the challenges that have arisen over the years.
Mm-hmm. Donna, we're now seeing big algae blooms in the lakes, too. What kind of damage are these blooms doing?
Well, the damage has got multiple aspects to it, too. One is the environmental impacts, which for a lot of these, we're still not fully aware of what they're causing in terms of impacts on fisheries and native species. And then there's the economic impacts that come with the recreational anglers and the commercial anglers going out and avoiding the blooms or not going fishing in those areas. And then there's the potential threats to human health. And a lot of people are aware that Toledo Water was shut down not too long ago in some other local areas because of the toxins in the water. So then you have entire cities and populations can no longer use the water. And it's a little bit more serious in some ways than bacterial contamination because you can't boil the water to get rid of the toxins. So then the people are really left without water in their homes and water to use in restaurants, and it's pretty serious impacts.
Harvey, I mean, these are five very large bodies of water. I mean, we're making statements that cover all five Great Lakes. I mean, can something be holding true for all of them?
There are some generalizations, but for example, when we talk about the impact of quagga mussels, which is one of the largest impacts we're looking at right now, that's confined primarily to the lower Great Lakes, Michigan, Huron, Ontario, and Erie. There are mussels in Lake Superior, but they don't, at least so far, they haven't been able to do very well there, partly because it's colder there and partly because the chemistry of Lake Superior is such that mussels have a hard time forming shells there.
Mm-hmm. Lots of people want to get in on this. Our number 844-724-8255. Let me go to some tweets that have come in. Let me go to Michelle, who says, I lived in Chicago my whole life, and I can swear that Lake Michigan is getting a brighter blue hue every summer. Anybody?
Well, yeah, it is. I mean, the lake looks spectacular from the surface, but, you know, it really belies the chaos that's going on underneath. As Harvey said earlier, clear water doesn't necessarily mean clean water. And I'll give you a real quick example, and Harvey, jump in if I botch something here. But here's an example of how this biological pollution can be just as problematic as anything coming out of a pipe or a smokestack. The mussels have so cleared the water on Lake Michigan that it's allowed for a type of algae to just explode, because that algae needs three things. It needs sunlight, it needs a hard surface, and it needs food. And the mussels provide all three by clearing up the water, by providing the surface with their shells, and then by feeding it with their excrement. So then this algae dies off, and it creates vast swaths of oxygen-deprived areas, and that allows a botulism bacteria to thrive. The mussels suck up this botulism bacteria. This is how the theory goes. And then another invasive species, a little fish about the size of your thumb called the round goby, eats these mussels. And then the mussels are carrying the botulism. The fish get botulism. They die. They float to the surface, and then they get eaten by birds. And birds are dying by the tens of thousands on the western, or I guess it'd be the eastern shore of Lake Michigan.
Hmm.
It's pretty frightening.
And I might add to that, too. I think that highlights one of the challenges we face with managing the Great Lakes, in that if you simply look at them from the outside, to many people, the lakes is a flat surface of water. And if you just look at it that way, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of problems with the lakes. And the real problems are under the surface, and that's a thing that most people don't see. The lakes have changed dramatically over the last 10 years, and most people are unaware of that because they see the lake as a flat surface. And I often make the analogy between lakes and, say, a terrestrial national park, where, say, if you lost the bison from Yellowstone National Park, a lot of people would be very upset about that because it's a very visible thing. We've had changes in Lake Michigan and the other Great Lakes that are just as drastic as that, but haven't raised the alarm as much because many people just don't see those changes.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Grand Haven, Michigan, to Brody. Hi, welcome.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering if someone from the panel could comment on the DNR seeding the Chinook salmon in Lake Michigan, and how their plans to stop seeding that program is going to affect the potential alewife situation in the lakes and where the flow of energy is going to go from there.
Okay. I can jump in on this.
Explain what he's talking about, please.
Okay, the DNR is the Department of Natural Resources, and there are four states bordering Lake Michigan, and they cooperatively manage the fishery. And since the first wave of invasive species arrived, the lakes have been heavily managed. Pacific salmon were brought in the 1960s to get control of an exploding alewife population, and that's an East Coast herring that made its way into the lakes through the shipping channels that we punched out to the Atlantic beginning in the early 1800s. So for the last 50 years or so, we've had a tremendous salmon fishery on the Great Lakes. The problem today is, as we were talking earlier, these mussels have so knocked out the bottom of the food chain that the alewives are starting to disappear. And as go the alewives, so go the salmon. And so there's a big debate right now about how many salmon these states should be planting in the lake annually, because they do drive, you know, the Great Lakes have a $7 billion fishery. Most of that is recreational. So there's a big debate about how much the hand of humans should be playing in this with all these changes going underway.
You agree, Donna?
Yeah, I'm not really familiar with the seining, the political aspect of it and the program, but yes, that he's exactly right, and it's the collapse of all the other things that come in with it.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Sean in Dayton. Hi, Sean. Welcome.
Thank you. Yeah, I have had the benefit of going to a family island up in Lake Huron off of Georgian Bay for the last 25 years, and we've seen the water level drop considerably over that time, and read a lot of the reasons for it, but one of the most interesting things I've read about and wondered if you could talk a little bit about is the idea of glacial rebounding as the Earth's crust has been bouncing back from the weight of the glaciers receding after the Ice Age.
Okay. Anybody know about that, Donna? So,
I can touch on that. Mm-hmm. So the glacial rebound is a phenomenon that you're absolutely correct, that after the weight of the glaciers have left the state, the land is coming back up. This process is occurring incredibly slow in terms of our timeline and humans' presence on Earth. So you would not, the lake levels are not, what you see as the lake levels from year to year and the changes in those are not necessarily related to that at all. Those are going to be more due to things like changes in the water, the evaporation rates over winter. If we lose more ice, they're going to be more evaporation rates, so we're going to have higher losses, and so you can have water lower levels there. So you've got a lot of climate factors, including rainfall and stuff like that, that play a role in it. But glacial rebound and the rate at which it happens, and I forgot what the exact amount is, it is actually quite small on a year-to-year basis, so we couldn't blame that on the fluctuations and annual changes in the water levels.
Mm-hmm. And we have a tweet from Susan who says, please speak about the water level crisis in Lake Ontario. Our shorelines are devastated. Thoughts on Plan 2014? Who'd like
to
talk?
Well, I'll just talk a little bit about lake levels. In Ontario, Lake Ontario is a long way from the western shore of Lake Michigan, where Harvey and I are today. But the lakes have really, Lake Ontario is at a record high right now. And what's been going on is, on Lakes Michigan and Huron, for 13 or 14 years, they were below, well below their long-term average. And the theory behind this is that you think that the lakes would be pretty immune to climate change because they're so vast and there's so much inertia built into the system, but they're actually turning out to be quite vulnerable because as the winters warm ever so subtly, we're not getting the ice cover that we have historically. So instead of having all this solar radiation bounced back up into the heavens during the middle of the winter and into the spring, the open water starts sucking up heat. And that means that by the time late summer comes, the lakes are warmer than they've been historically. And then when, you know, the gales in November come blowing in with their cold winds, that temperature differential creates massive evaporation, and the lakes literally get sucked into the sky. So the problem was low water just until about 2 years ago. And then something about 3 years ago, then the polar vortex kicked in, which is something nobody was predicting, nobody I knew was predicting, and especially predicting the impact it would have on the lakes. It brought exceptional ice cover, and the lakes rebounded fast. Wow. And that's what we're experiencing even to this day. And it's been a wet spring, too.
I'm Ira Flato. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking about the various aspects of the Great Lakes and welcoming your calls, 844-724-8255. You can also reach us at SciFry, SCIFRI. Lots of people wanting to ask about the Great Lakes. Let's go to a couple of more phone calls here. Let's go to Kenneth in Janesville, Wisconsin. Hi, Kenneth.
Hello.
Hey there.
I wondered about dealing with the mollusks overpopulation, and what's the prospect for dealing with them?
Okay. Are they edible? Could you make escargot out of them?
Unfortunately, there's no simple answers to that challenge. They're probably not edible. There may be concerns about contaminant concentrations in them because they're filter feeders, although there may be other prospects. I've half-jokingly suggested to people that maybe they could be harvested for fertilizer or pet food or something like that. But as far as reducing their numbers in the Great Lakes go, there are really no management options to do that. There are options if you're dealing with smaller lakes or reservoirs. Mm-hmm. There are certain types of treatments that you can apply that will really reduce mussel numbers or in some cases even eliminate them. But if mussels disappear from the Great Lakes, it's not going to be because anything we do. It's going to be because of some other natural or biological process happening to the system, either a parasite or some disease or mm-hmm. some other predator that comes in and eats lots of them.
All right. I'm going to take a break and we'll come back and talk more about the Great Lakes. But we're going to also talk about the president's skinny budget, what that means, major programs being cut aimed at cleaning up the Great Lakes. We'll check on how big the impact could be, plus more on the future of these vast ecosystems. 844-724-8255. Tweet at SciFry. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. We've been talking about the challenges behind and ahead for the Great Lakes, from invasive species to climate change. But there is another one we haven't touched on, and that is money. The Great Lakes Restoration Initiative funds more than $300 million worth of projects to restore fish habitat, clean up pollution, and otherwise improve the lakes. And in the federal skinny budget the White House released this spring, most of that budget would be eliminated. Add that to other agency cuts, and the Great Lakes could lose many of the projects aimed at keeping them usable. Here to explain the money is Elizabeth Miller, reporter and producer for Great Lakes Today, based in Cleveland. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
What is the extent of the proposed cuts?
So, as you said, the GLRI funds Great Lakes restoration projects, gives $300 million annually. And so Trump's skinny budget completely slashes that to zero. And in addition to that, it looks like we'll be losing grants and education programs through the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, Superfund site cleanup, and cuts to the Department of Agriculture, which could mean loss of subsidies for new farming practices, things like cover crops that reduce nutrient runoff.
And so how vital are these projects to the continued or improved health of the Great Lakes?
Well, a lot of these projects, what the federal money does is that it leverages state and local money to go towards these projects. And so having that pot of money that groups can ask for and can submit proposals for really helps out a lot of these restoration projects. And over 2,000 projects have received funding from the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative since 2010.
Canada also borders on the Great Lakes. We know could cuts to restoration efforts affect international relationships?
Yes, completely. And there's a lot of different plans that really relate to the U.S. and Canada. I mean, this is a binational body of water. And so what we're doing is being watched very closely by Canada. And they're just as concerned as some of the environmental organizations that I've spoken to here on the U.S. side of the Great Lakes.
You know, this is just very puzzling because it's counterintuitive for we observers outside of the region, because we know that Michigan, Wisconsin, Ohio, these are the very key states that the Trump administration depended on for support in winning the election, and yet now they're proposing to cut the money to keep their lakes healthy.
Yeah, and what's really interesting about this Great Lakes Restoration Initiative and all of these different cuts proposed related to the Great Lakes is that they're a very bipartisan issue. We've got politicians on every side of the aisle, Republicans, Democrats, Independents, everyone has pledged to fight this cut. And just yesterday, actually, two representatives from Ohio, Dave Joyce and Marcy Kaptur, questioned the new EPA administrator, Scott Pruitt, asking, are you going to take care of our Great Lakes? Are you going to help get this funding back to $300 million? And he says he recognizes the importance of the Great Lakes.
But no commitment.
No commitment. And Marcy Kaptur, a representative from Ohio here, actually invited him to tour the Great Lakes, which he accepted. So maybe that will change his mind.
Well, she's taking a chance by inviting the person who won't give them any money.
Yeah, and I think what she wants to show is that change that's happened over the last 6 years, especially with this Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, is a lot of these projects wouldn't get done, wouldn't get funded at all without the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative.
It's baffling. It just sounds like politically you're just shooting yourself in the foot. But, you know,
yeah.
What do I know about the politics? All I remember from the 60s, the lakes catching on fire and the environmental movement happening, and they were sort of the instigators of the environmental movement.
Yeah, it's actually the anniversary of the Cuyahoga River catching fire next week, and I know there are some local organizations that are really proud of how far the river's come.
Well, thank you very much, Elizabeth, for taking time to talk with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And good luck. Elizabeth Miller is a reporter for the Great Lakes Today in Cleveland. We're also talking about the Great Lakes. And our number again, if you'd like to, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry, talking with Dan Egan, Harvey Bootsma, and Donna Cashin. Any reaction to that? Let me ask you, Dan, what do you think? How do you square this circle?
Well, we don't want to go backwards, and it seems that we are. You know, the Cuyahoga River fire was famous because, you know, it really did mark the beginning of the end for industry to just dump what they wanted in the lakes. But what was really important about that fire wasn't that the river caught fire. It was the last time the river caught fire. It had burned from the 1800s forward, and for some reason people tolerated it for 100 years or so, and then for some reason, they just decided enough is enough. And we had a Cuyahoga-like moment just in 2014, also on Lake Erie. And it really kind of shows the state of the lakes and the direction we could be headed due to a number of problems. And I'll just talk real quickly about what happened in Toledo. Okay, so when we talk about these mussels, you can't eat them. They're really small. But the important thing is not to look at them as individuals, but just as, you know, the mass that they are. As Harvey once explained to me, I could walk from Milwaukee 80 miles across Lake Michigan to Muskegon on a bed of quagga mussels at densities up to 100,000 per square meter. And that's because they cluster on top of each other and create this kind of gnarled coral-like stuff, and they filter everything out of the water. It's a similar situation on Lake Erie. And what's happened over there in the Western Basin is that three things have just kind of come together. There's a mussel infestation, there's overapplication of fertilizer on the croplands, specifically the cornfields west of Lake Erie, and with climate change, we're getting bigger spring storms. So we get these big pulses of rain, and they wash the fertilizer into the water. And in the 1960s, that fertilizer might have spawned algae outbreaks, an assemblage of a bunch of different types of algae. But these mussels, these brainless mussels, are just smart enough to not eat a certain type of toxic algae on Lake Erie. So it's selected, they have selected for this toxic algae called Microcystis. And so when you get an algae bloom today, it's more likely to be this toxic stuff. You can see it on YouTube, mussels sucking everything out of the water but spitting back these flecks, and these flecks are toxic algae. So those blooms happen, and in the summer of 2014, one of them went right into the Toledo drinking water intake and knocked out the drinking water source for almost 500,000 people, and you couldn't just boil it out. It wasn't like, you know, a standard boil order until we get the system fixed. Mm. If you boiled it, you would concentrate the toxins. So you got a city of like 500,000 people, and they can't drink their water. And even in the dark days of the, you know, Cuyahoga River burning, the lake was never so bad that you couldn't treat it to drinking water standards. So going backwards at this time and eliminating this Great Lakes Restoration Initiative threatens programs underway to get a handle on these toxic algae blooms. And I don't see how that will, you know, hold any popular support. And you got to remember, this budget is just—it's the administration's first crack. Congress is the one that will set it, or the members will set it. And you know, as it's been said, these are not partisan issues. Clean water.
You think that eventually that money will come back? Just too political.
I'm confident it will to some degree, but I don't. Yeah. I'm not privy to any.
Yeah. We'll see.
And Ira, if I could just add a bit to what Dan said regarding your question about whether it's worth putting funding into the Great Lakes, when you evaluate ecosystem services, it's more challenging than evaluating, say, the profitability of a certain business. We get huge benefits from the Great Lakes, and there's been a number of economic assessments done of the Great Lakes, all of which show that money invested in the Great Lakes produces a return on investment anywhere from twofold to fivefold. The challenge is that in many cases it's difficult for people to see or realize the benefits that we get from the Great Lakes. The number of $7 billion per year for the sport fishery is commonly cited, and that's true, but there's other huge benefits that we get from the Great Lakes that are easy to overlook. The simple fact that Great Lakes are amazing water purification systems, and the quality of water that we get from Great Lakes for municipal supply for drinking and other uses is a huge benefit that we get from the lakes that most people don't value. They don't put a number on that. And so I think that's part of the challenge here is getting policymakers and managers to realize the value of these systems. It's a classic case of you don't know what you have until it's gone. And if we don't manage the systems, we will realize how important they are.
That brings it full circle on that song. Let me see. We have a lot of tweets that have come in. Let me see if I can cycle through a few of them here. Doug writes, hey, Sci-Fi, all this talk of invasive species and no mention of Asian carp. Where does that stand?
Well, fortunately, as far as we know, Asian carp are not in Lake Michigan yet. They're knocking at the door. They're coming up the Mississippi River and the Illinois River system. There have been some signs that maybe they're in the system. People have sampled for what's called environmental DNA, which tells you if a species might be in the water. And that has occasionally provided positive hits that says they might be there, but no one has caught one yet. So the best we can do right now is based on what we know about mm-hmm. both the lakes and the Asian carp is try to predict what will happen. And that has been done by researchers at the NOAA Great Lakes Lab in Ann Arbor and also at Michigan State University. And their forecast suggests that the impact would be relatively modest in Lake Michigan, partly because quagga mussels have beat them to the punch. The Asian carp are filter feeders. They feed on plankton. But there's just not a lot of that left in Lake Michigan because quagga mussels have eaten a lot of that. They would do better in Lake Erie because there's more plankton for them to feed on in Lake Erie.
Donna Cashian, let me ask you a question about pollution. You know, we have seen in recent weeks as there was this island in the Pacific with all this plastic that has washed up on it. Are there beaches on the Great Lakes with plastic that is washing up or other pharmaceuticals or things like that in the water now? Runoff?
Yeah, if you go to any beach in the Great Lakes and any beach anywhere, you find little plastic pieces everywhere. And those are the ones you can see. There's also the microbead plastics that we've recently had a ban on. And the microbeads are the plastics that are found in the products for like the scrubs for washing your face and stuff like that. And I think that's a wonderful example of us being proactive and actually anticipating that these could cause an environmental impact, and they have been banned in the Great Lakes, and that's a wonderful thing. Normally, we are a very reactive society. We wait until everything's dying or some river's on fire, and then we start initiating mm-hmm. changes in policy. And that's a really good example of something that we made a change before it became more of a problem. In terms of the other things, like pharmaceuticals, we don't know what impact this is going to have. There is no doubt if you go out and take a water sample from almost any water body, surface water, that you are going to have an amount of pharmaceuticals in it. They come from agricultural products. They come from wastewater from humans. They're made to be biologically active, and they pass through and end up in the wastewater. And right now, there are currently no regulations on them in the water, and we don't know the effects. But we know whenever you have water, we are now consuming pharmaceuticals and other contaminants, personal care products, when we do so. So there's a lot to be done on that and understanding. We've seen feminization of fish from some chemicals that are known to disrupt endocrine disruption. And so what are the impacts on humans? We can't do human testing, so we really don't know yet.
Yeah.
So we need more research and more understanding on these. And if possible, if we need to enact some kind of control or treatment to our drinking water that will eliminate these. But right now, we don't have enough information.
This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Sorry to have to jump in there on you. I'm Ira Flato, talking about the Great Lakes. Just a few more minutes and lots of tweets. Let me go to 4R Nutrients writes, it's not over-application of fertilizer. It's fertilizer applied at the wrong time and place. Anybody want to comment on that?
Well, yeah, I mean that is a problem. But you know, back in the 1960s, when the Cuyahoga River was burning and Lake Erie was declared by some national publications as dead, it really wasn't. But it did have these massive areas of oxygen depleted water because of all the algae blooms, and then when they would burn, when they would die, they would burn up the oxygen. We solved that problem by basically, I'm talking about Lake Erie right now, by putting it on a phosphorus diet, and they dramatically cut the loading going into the lake, and as predicted, the lake recovered really quickly from 1971 to 1985. The change was just dramatic. Well, we're back to these massive dead zones again, and the problem isn't that any more phosphorus is going into the lake than there was once the lake was declared recovered. It's that it's coming off croplands in a very potent form, it's called dissolved reactive phosphorus, and it's just like gasoline in terms of algae bloom explosions. So once again, we have a prescription. Mm-hmm. They want to cut the loading by 40%. And, you know, the scientists were right back in the 60s and 70s, and there's every reason to believe that they'd be right today and that we can fix this problem. But so far, we haven't had the political will to do so.
One last quick question from Andrea, who tweets, can you discuss attempts to pump Great Lake water to other states? Ramifications of doing this.
So this has been an issue that has come to the forefront recently, and those sitting in Wisconsin are even closer to it. But yeah, so there is now water withdrawals happening, not only being pumped out, but also companies trying withdrawing, like Nestle withdrawing water for bottling purposes. And this is something these Great Lakes don't just belong to the United States; they belong to Canada too. And we got to be really careful about that, because once we have made it legal to pump water, as countries further west need water, there's going to be more and more pressure to justify for human sustainability to have water moved out of the Great Lakes. And we have to be very careful. It's a slippery slope, and we have to be very protective of the water to maintain the resource, because the more pressure and removal, the more impact on the system we're going to see.
Well, I want to thank you all. I mean, I'm glad we took time to talk about this, because this is such an important issue and it gets so little coverage that we see on all the coasts. So I want to thank all of my guests, Dan Egan, reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Senior Water Policy Fellow, University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. And you can read an excerpt of his book, sciencefriday.com/lakes. It's a great book, The Death and Life of the Great Lakes. Donna Cashian is a associate professor of aquatic ecology at Wayne State University in Brighton, Michigan. And Harvey Bootsma is associate professor of freshwater sciences at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. Thank you all for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. B.J. Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. Once again, just a reminder, it is Cephalopod Week. Up on our website at sciencefriday.com, we're celebrating all things cephalopod, local cephalopod cephalopodies, get it, are happening all around the country. You can start your own. Have a great weekend, and again, happy Father's Day to everybody. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flato in New York.